Good evening. My name is Dr. Elliot Malamut. First, I wanted to thank Rabbi Mordechai Bookbinder for helping to facilitate the event. Also, my colleague at Torah in Motion, Rabbi Jay Kelman. On behalf of my mother, Ahuva, my sister, Ruth Hart, her husband, Phil, and their family, my brother, Dan, and his wife, Dawn, my wife, Leah, and our children, I want to welcome you to this evening's program, which is being held in honor of the third yahrzeit of my father, Colin Malamut, Zichron Livracha. I want to ask my sister Ruth to step up and say a few words about our father.
Elliot, a few words? I have an ongoing thing here with Dan. I said this is 2.5 minutes, and he's saying closer to 10, but we'll find something in the middle. I'm sure that many of you are feeling as I do today, walking a little taller, a little more confidently, with glowing pride and trust in our Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, for presenting Canada's clear and principled position with regard to Israel and on anti-Semitism. The National Post's headline yesterday rang out boldly, PM stands with Israel. At a conference in Ottawa on anti-Semitism, Prime Minister Harper said unequivocally that he would not feign neutrality in order to win friends and votes at the UN, but that when Israel, the only country in the world whose very existence is under attack, we are morally obligated to take a stand. It is freedom that makes us human. Whether it leads to heroism or depravity depends on how we use it. We have a solemn duty to defend the vulnerable, to challenge the aggressor, to protect and promote human dignity at home and abroad. The State of Israel appeared as a light in a world emerging from deep darkness. Against all odds, that light has not been extinguished. It burns bright, upheld by the universal principles of all civilized nations, freedom, democracy, justice. These words spoken with passion yesterday about Canada's integrity and loyal friendship to Israel describes just as well the essence of a man who lived through the ravages of World War II, who escaped the Holocaust, and the battle for Israel's independence when the Jewish people were wrenched from the womb of British Mandate Palestine and was reborn as Israel. That man was our father, Colin Malamut, Zichron Livracha. Some of you will remember my father well, and most of you in this room did not have that opportunity. So I will tell you his story, which I think you will find very unexpected and inspiring. He was born in Dresden, Germany, and spent his early childhood in Leipzig. The threatening clouds of war in Europe, the reality on the street, and his family were the influences that would impact his every decision and action for the rest of his life. His love of classical music was nourishment for his soul. He sang in a boys' choir until his voice changed around the age of 11. His love of reading, learning Torah, and strong family values were nurtured by his grandfather, Baruch Zelnick, and his courage to fight injustice and stand up in the face of inhumanity came from his father, Nachum, a staunch activist who was ultimately kidnapped by the Nazis, tortured, and murdered. This traumatic news reached my father shortly after his mother procured a visa and found him safe haven in England in the late 30s, before war broke out. Anguished, angry, in despair, and alone, my father was placed with a family in London. He was restless and in search of a way to channel his energies to make a difference. The answer came with the opportunity to set sail for Palestine, where he was reunited with his mother and brothers. My father was excited by the prospect of building a new country. For a while, he worked the land on his cousin's dairy and produce farm in Bertuvia, a farming village. But ultimately, he was more suited to books, academia, and a desk job. He worked in the engineering department of British Mandate government, and in his free time surrounded himself with young Zionistic intellectuals and scholars, helping to edit journals about Jewish folklore and ethnology. He was handsome and social, and women found him attractive and engaging. My father's feelings about the Jewish people, about Israel, and about the need to survive were unambiguous. And so, when he was called upon to risk his life for the struggling Jewish homeland, he did not hesitate. He joined the Haganah as an intelligence spy. This appealed to his sense of duty and responsibility. His contributions led to the successful attack and conquering of the Schneller compound, the strategic outpost for the British, a structure considered impenetrable for its stone walls and iron gates. During that time in Jerusalem, he met the love of his life, my mother, Ahuva Slonim. She reminisces about those romantic years of parties by the Dead Sea under the stars. Those were exciting times. My mother typing the news of the day with bullets flying through the window of the British press office, and my father working as the manager of a pencil factory by day and a spy by night. When the State of Israel was born and they married, they decided to spread their wings and see the world, an adventure that brought them to Canada. It was here that they settled and raised a family. My brothers and I grew up in Montreal and Toronto, with some time spent as well in New York. My father's love for Israel was never-ending theme in his life. He worked as the executive director of the Canada-Israel Chamber of Commerce and Industry, responsible for planning some business missions to Israel, where he personally introduced and forged lifelong connections between Toronto executives and some of Israel's greatest leaders, including Golda Meir and Menachem Begin. And if, in his quiet way, my father was able to guide and influence, his impact was even more profound at home, in the most subtle of ways. As a role model, we adopted his interests and love of literature, of music, the pursuit of education and knowledge, current events, and politics. Our father imbued in us a strong work ethic, the values of honesty and integrity, and devotion and commitment to family. My father was not one to climb the social ladder. He preferred the comfort and serenity of home with his family. We all managed to survive, if not unscathed, the power struggles of our youth with this man of books and ideals from another era, but we respected him nonetheless. My father, the lion, became a lamb in his later years, and his greatest rewards were dancing at his children's weddings and becoming a grandfather to Adam, Jordana, Talia, David Tzvi, Akiva, and Tanya. Saba was nanny and elder statesman to these young apples of his eye, and he left the world 3 years ago quietly and contentedly, with the knowledge that his love and commitment to the highest values was being carried forward in the next generation. He would be very happy and encouraged by the high level of inquiry and discussion that is going to go on in this shul, in this sanctuary, this evening.
Next Friday is the 147th anniversary of one of the most famous speeches in the history of the Western world. It is only 2 minutes long, but though short, it stands as a monument to eloquence and to importance. Among its concluding sentences are the following. It is for us, the living, rather, to be dedicated here to the unfinished work which they who fought here have thus far so nobly advanced. It is rather for us to be here dedicated to the great task remaining before us, that from these honored dead, we take increased devotion to that cause for which they gave the last full measure of devotion. So spoke Abraham Lincoln on the afternoon of November 19, 1863, at the dedication of the Soldiers' National Cemetery in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And we are all gathered here the day after Kristallnacht, and also on the eve of Remembrance Day, we must think deeply and intensely about President Lincoln's last full measure of devotion, of what we as a culture and a society believe in, and what are the sacrifices required to maintain the freedom which those who came before us fought so long and so hard to help us enjoy. Tonight our topic is nothing short of the direction to be taken in Western civilization. It's my unequivocal pleasure to introduce the speaker for this evening. Melanie Phillips was raised and educated in London before attending Oxford University. She's had a distinguished career as a journalist. Currently, her articles appear chiefly in the Daily Mail newspaper, and they cover political and social issues. She has also written for The Guardian, is a regular panelist on the BBC Radio 4 program The Moral Maze, BBC One's Question Time. She was awarded the Orwell Prize for Journalism in 1996 and is the author of 4 books, including Londonistan, which was published in the United States and the United Kingdom in 2006 and immediately became a bestseller. Her latest book, The World Turned Upside Down, The Global Battle Over God, Truth, and Power, was published in April 2010. And in it, Ms. Phillips argues the following, quote, "In what we tell ourselves in an age is an age of reason, we are behaving increasingly irrationally. Truth and lies, right and wrong, victim and aggressor are all turned upside down. Israel is ferociously demonized. The United States is vilified over the war on terror, all on the basis of falsehoods and propaganda that are believed as truth. Thus, the West is losing both its rationality and its freedoms. While the Islamists are intent on returning the free world to the 7th century, the West no longer seems willing or able to defend the modernity and rationalism that it brought into being." I first met Melanie Phillips a year ago when we were introduced through our mutual friend, Rabbi Harvey Belofsky, of the Golders Green Synagogue in London. Ms. Phillips invited me to her flat in Bloomsbury, where we spent a lovely morning over tea and biscuits, discussing some of the issues you will hear about this evening. I invited her to continue our conversation in Toronto, and she graciously accepted. Her views are not without controversy, but in her case, I think this is a sign of great thoughtfulness and sober reflection on some of the most important ideas of our time. Both my brother Dan and myself had the privilege of studying with the political philosopher Alan Bloom. Professor Bloom used to say that when people get upset with you simply for expressing a contrary view, then you know you have touched a nerve, and that touching a nerve is not such a bad thing after all. Of Ms. Phillips, we can say that she touches the right nerves at just the right time, and our world is badly in need of her work and her determination. Please welcome Melanie Phillips. After 9/11, many people in the West wrung their hands and asked the following question: why do they hate us? Mark Stein, in his book Lights Out, proclaims that this is actually the wrong question for Westerners to ask. The real question is, why do we hate us? Why do we feel apologetic about the values we stand for as a culture, the freedoms we have worked so hard to proclaim? Why are we defensive when we should be proud? Why are we apologetic when we should be fiery? My first question to you is, why do we hate us?
Well, there are many reasons, I think, why so many in the West have come to hate the West. And I think that what we're talking about and what you're asking me about is a phenomenon which, by and large, is confined, I would say, to the intelligentsia. The people who are the custodians of reason, who in many respects I think have become very irrational and unreasonable. And one of their characteristics is that they have a great degree of cultural guilt under which they labor, and which makes them have a kind of default position that what the West stands for and what it's done in the past is illegitimate and wrong. And to a certain extent, you could say that it comes from particulars of history. I mean, I've come from Britain, and Britain has colonial guilt. It ran an empire. The empire then freed itself of British colonial control. And the British have now told themselves a story that the empire was simply all bad. And you have a situation in which, even more than that, the Archbishop of Canterbury has gone on record as apologising to the Third World for the export to it of Christianity, on the basis that this was a kind of colonialist, theological colonialist enterprise, which stamped on the indigenous cultures of the developed, the undeveloped world. In other words, to the Archbishop of Canterbury, it was as good, if not better, to have been, for example, a cannibal than to be a Christian. And so the question is why people like this hold this kind of view. And I can't really answer that question, but a very considerable part of that answer has to do with what I think has taken over the progressive intelligentsia in the West. And again, I must emphasize I'm speaking mainly from the position of Britain, because that's really the country I know best. And this may not quite correspond with what's happened in Canada, but you may find some resonances. But the progressive intelligentsia has basically been taken over by what I would consider to be a Marxist analysis of the world, in which every group that holds power is bad, and every group that is powerless is good. And the group that holds power can do no good, and the group that holds that it is powerless can do no bad. So even when groups that are powerless, the Third World, for example, commits atrocities, 9/11, they cannot be held responsible because they are the victims of us, and therefore it's actually our fault that they are behaving like that. It is a quite mad inversion that is going on. And there's also something else that goes on that explains this inversion, which says if the Third World does bad, it must be our fault, which is this, and this was brought home to me in the early 1980s when I was an editorial writer for The Guardian. And I would say to my colleagues at The Guardian, particularly in respect of the Middle East, but not just in respect of the Middle East, it also applied to places like China, going through the Cultural Revolution, and other places where tyranny had people in its thrall. I would say to my colleagues, why is it that if Syria murders 20, 30,000 people, whatever it was, in one weekend, we treat it to nine paragraphs on page 16. Whereas if Israel kills three Palestinians, it's a front page splash, it's an outrage editorial, it's several anguished columns, and there's general hysteria. Why is there a double standard? And they said to me, well, of course there's a double standard, because we cannot expect the Third World to adhere to our standards. We, in the West, have as our principal value the value of human life. The Third World does not have any respect for the value of human life, and therefore we cannot judge them by our standards, because that would be racist. To which I said, let me get my head round this. You're saying that if you are someone who lives in the Third World, you don't have the same rights to life and liberty as people like us. Isn't that racist? And they said, no, you've got this completely wrong. And that is, I'm afraid, the default position, also the progressive intelligentsia, that it is racist to have any kind of hierarchy of values, and therefore everyone else's values must be the same value as our own. And therefore, what follows is that our own values actually stink, and theirs are better. And that's part of the reason for guilt, that we cannot possibly think that the empire was any good, because by definition it was bad, because we are by definition bad. It's crazy, And if you stop thinking about it for long enough, you get a terrible migraine. And you think that possibly you're going to go crazy, so you might be much better off going, you know, baking a cake, quite frankly.
And you're tracing this shift in England, because I'm thinking about what my sister said. You know, my dad came to an England, and I think many people who've not been to England recently have a kind of iconic memory of England, of, you know, Churchill's speeches, of a stoic people standing up to, you know, the enemy and injustice. And I think there's a sort of frozen memory in their mind of that kind of England, and something has changed very radically. So you're tracing that essentially to empire, to guilt over empire?
Well, I think this is a longer and more complicated process. Everyone thinks of Churchill, and everyone thinks of the British as those plucky people with their backs to the wall in 1940, and that was indeed true, as an iconic moment. And it was made to stand for Britain as a kind of the sort of epitome of what it was to be British by George Orwell, who celebrated and heroised that period. And so people come to think that was Britain, but it wasn't. It wasn't. You mentioned Churchill. I wasn't around at the time, but as I understand it, when Churchill was doing his thing in the 30s, warning Britain about appeasement of Hitler, warning that Britain had to rearm, warning that war was coming, he was kept off the BBC as a dangerous lunatic. The 30s was a period in which the similarities of today are really quite remarkable, where you had people who thought that Hitler was a clown, that he couldn't possibly be taken seriously, that what he was saying was so preposterous nobody could ever possibly take it seriously, that the people who were saying this was to be taken seriously were alarmist, and that it was all the fault of those wretched Jews. If only they would shut up and go away, everything would be fine. And it was only really a stupendous, fortunate accident of fate that Churchill existed. And the trouble is, today, where is Churchill? Now, I was, you know, I'm British, and it was, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven when I heard Mr. Harper a couple of days ago. I mean, look, where I'm coming from, the Prime Minister, the Conservative Prime Minister, the new Conservative Prime Minister, David Cameron, and his Foreign Secretary, William Hague, are on record as having issued condolences to the victims of the Mavi Marmara, the victims of the Israeli attack on the Turkish terrorist flotilla ship, and talk about Gaza as a prison camp. That's where I'm coming from. That's my country. So, you know, people like Mr. Harper, or in Australia, there are a couple of politicians who were and are excellent. There are one or two around the world. But basically, we don't have a Churchill at the moment to rouse the world to the danger that it faces and the difficult decisions it has to take to face those dangers, which I find particularly frightening. So when you come to Britain, you know, where is, you know, the country of Churchill? Well, I'm afraid the British lion has become rather moth-eaten. I mean, you all remember the terrible jibe which we all laughed so much about the French being cheese-eating surrender monkeys. Well, Britain just recently did a deal, a defence deal with France. We give them the warship, they give us the sailors, or something like that. It's called the Entente Frugale. And the signals, you know, it's one of the signals of the end of Britain as a nation that's prepared to defend itself and to defend the West. And so what we have in Britain is no longer the British lion. We have a cheese-eating surrender lion now in Britain.
Let's turn to your particular domain, which is that of print and TV media. When one watches the BBC or reads transcripts from the various assemblies of the United Nations, or reads certain newspapers, or books like Jimmy Carter's Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid, for me personally, and I can only speak for myself, I sometimes have the feeling that they're simply not viewing the same world that I'm viewing. They're not, that our perspectives are quite a kilter. And I've been thinking about language that gets used in media, and there's been a quite vigorous debate over the last number of years about what kinds of words you use to assess acts. So suicide bombers in places like Reuters and the BBC are called militants or they're called fighters, but they're not called terrorists, and there's all sorts of editorial policies that govern this. The Israeli operation in 2008 in Gaza was immediately, almost before it got off the ground, branded as disproportionate, even though years of rockets falling on Sderot were sort of erased from the public memory. Hamas charter, which explicitly calls for the liquidation of Israel. I've read the charter. Every piece of Israel, from Rosh HaNikra to Eilat, east to west, all of it will be part of the caliphate, is rationalized as a necessary rejoinder to the occupation, despite its explicit call to retain Palestine under Islamic control. My question is as follows. The folks at the BBC and the UN are not stupid people. They have the same facts available as we do. I guess I'm a bit puzzled what accounts for this sort of willful overlooking of the most basic information, and I want to triangulate the question a bit. Some people will say it's simply anti-Semitism in contemporary garb, and I guess I could go that way. I find myself not wanting to go that way because I guess I don't want to play that card unless I have to, but is it simply anti-Semitic, hiding behind sort of the fig leaf of criticism of Israel? Or is there more complex sort of socio-political calculations at work here? In England, the need to appease the Muslim street, or the need for Arab oil, or something else entirely. Like, in other words, what am I missing in this picture?
Well, this is a very complicated question to unpack. Indeed, one could write a whole book about it. Oh, I think I've just done that. Let's just unpick a little bit. The BBC and the UN, you lump them together. Much as I have an issue with the BBC, it's not the UN. The UN, where's the UN coming from? Well, look, the UN is basically a club of terror. Unfortunately, posing as the parliament of the world. But basically, that was fine when the UN was created because it was, you know, a few countries that actually had fought the good fight that created the Parliament of the World. But now the world is full of terrible, terrible regimes, and the UN is dominated by those regimes, and dominated in particular by the regimes of the Organization of the Islamic Conference, the Islamic World, which drives the UN agenda. The UN consists of countries which are tyrannies and despotisms, and which are in the business of perpetuating themselves as tyrannies and despotisms. And consequently, the UN serves those purposes. Now, to folk at the BBC, and the BBC, I think, stands proxy for the progressive intelligentsia in Britain, the UN can do no wrong. Because the UN is the parliament of the world, it must therefore stand for the brotherhood of man. The progressive intelligentsia believes at the moment in an orthodoxy called, I know it's a terrible jargon phrase, but it's called transnational progressivism. And what this basically amounts to is the belief that the nation is the source of all the ills of the world. Why is the nation the source of all the ills of the world? Well, nations give rise to nationalism, and nationalism gives rise to prejudice and war. So abolish or diminish the nation, and you abolish or diminish prejudice and war. Hey presto, you have the brotherhood of man. So instead of the nation, what's preferable is to have institutions and codes of laws which are transnational, which don't belong to any one particular nation, because particular nations are rooted in particulars of history and language and religion, and therefore are basically illegitimate, because they are particular, they by definition exclude people who are not of them. Therefore, because you know you are British and you basically believe that being British is all to do with a particular language, a particular religion, a particular history, a particular set of values, that is in and of itself racist, because people who are not British don't have those things. Okay? So you have transnational progressivism, in which the brotherhood of man, the community of the world, the community where different nations come together, is automatically better than the nation. So the United Nations, as the ultimate expression of this kind of thinking cannot do wrong. Now, you ask how it is that very intelligent people in the UN or the BBC can just ignore what is so patently obvious about a whole range of issues, but particularly Israel and the Middle East. But I would say it is a whole range of issues. The UN is hostile to Israel because the constituent nations of the UN who dominate it are hostile to Israel and want to see Israel destroyed. The BBC is hostile to Israel because of a number of things. It is not just Jew hatred. I hate this word, anti-Semitism. I know Jew hatred is ugly, but at least it's slightly more accurate. At least it wasn't invented by an anti-Semite, as anti-Semitism was. So Jew hatred is part of it, but it's by no means the whole, because the BBC's attitude to Israel is all of a piece with a general way of looking at the world, which is the way of the progressive intelligentsia. And if there are members of the progressive intelligentsia in this room this evening, I do apologise. I'm afraid I'm going to stamp extremely heavily on every corn that you have. The progressive intelligentsia is defined, in my view, by one most important fact, which is that the kind of things that it believes can be all classified under the umbrella of ideologies. Now, an ideology is basically the dogma of a particular idea. And what an ideology inescapably does is it acts against truth and reason. Why? Because whereas ordinary thinking looks at evidence, looks at facts, and then reaches a conclusion, an ideology starts with the conclusion, starts with the idea, and then wrenches the facts to fit the idea. And any facts that don't fit the idea don't exist. They have no value at all. They are simply, by definition, wrong. Now, the progressive intelligentsia subscribes to a whole variety of ideologies. Let me list just some of them. Anti-imperialism, anti-capitalism, anti-Americanism, anti-Zionism. Those all go in a kind of bunch together. Then beyond that, there is multiculturalism. There is environmentalism. There is extreme feminism. There is what is called scientism, which is the belief that everything in the world, the universe and beyond is explicable by scientifically materialist explanations, including the origins of the world, the universe and beyond. Now, these are all ideologies. There are more, but these are all ideologies. And virtually everything that the BBC journalists think, and the BBC journalists stand proxy for the intelligentsia that produces them. And these attitudes go right through the intelligentsia and the governing class, certainly in Britain. Virtually everything that they believe comes under the heading of an ideology of one kind or another. Anti-Zionism is one such ideology. And so they cannot see the evidence that is so obvious to you and me. They simply cannot see it. And when you bring it to them, they say, because they don't believe in truth, because that's part of moral relativism. There's no such thing as truth. What is true for me? What is true for you? These things are relative. It's my opinion. It's your opinion. When you bring forward evidence of history about the Middle East, history of the Jewish people, the facts on the ground of what's happening in Gaza, what's happening in this place, that place, it's just your opinion. It's just your opinion. And your opinion as a Jew, and worse, as a Zionist Jew, is, of course, holy party pre, unlike my opinion, because I am part of the progressive intelligentsia, and therefore my opinion is neutral. And that is the way of thinking. And so when you have this amplified in the BBC, it becomes a catastrophe, because the BBC is unique in the world as being synonymous throughout the world with objectivity and truth-telling. And consequently, people believe it. They believe it implicitly in a way that they don't believe other broadcasting organisations or other media. So the damage the BBC has done and continues to do through promulgating, which is basically an ideological view of the world as truth, is inestimable.
I can feel myself getting depressed. I guess one of the most perplexing irrationalities that has emerged lately in public discourse is the common cause that's been made by certain feminists and gay rights activists with purveyors of terror, the strangest bedfellows imaginable. What you call in Londonistan a jaw-dropping axis with militant fundamentalist Islam. We in Toronto had a recent and quite bizarre example of this past summer, where a group calling itself Queers Against Israeli Apartheid marched in the Toronto Pride Parade. Their slogan was, "We stand with queers in Palestine," which struck me as odd to say the least, given the fact that Israel is the only country in the Middle East that is openly supportive of gay rights. Gays in other countries in the region, has been well documented from everyone from the left to the right, are often brutally suppressed and persecuted. So I guess I'm wondering, how do you explain groups on the left supporting ideologies that actually repress or deny the very things that leftists stand for?
Well, the immediate answer to that was given by someone from the Socialist Workers' Party, I think it was some years ago, who explained this. And because he was from the Socialist Workers' Party, it took like hundreds of pages of closely argued, unreadable so-called thinking. But as far as I could understand what he was saying was, we're all basically brothers together because we both basically believe in the same thing, which is smash the system. The extreme left will march alongside the Islamists and vice versa because they basically have the same aim in mind, which is to destroy Western civilization and its culture. What they wish to put in its place is somewhat different, to put it mildly, but they will subordinate their profound differences, or allegedly profound differences, over things like gay rights, women's rights, and no doubt the finer details of economic management. They will subordinate all of that to the aim of using each other's proletariat as marching fodder and as literally ammunition for the fight against the West. So that's one of the most obvious reasons. But I have to say, also, having delved into this a little bit more in the course of writing my book, there are correspondences, quite remarkable correspondences, between the two sides. All kinds of Islamist ideologues, going back to the 20s and 30s, the time when radical Muslims emerging out of colonialist control in Islamic countries, really developed the modern version of politicized Islam that we see today. Those people drew very, very heavily on communist thinking, communist thinkers, for all kinds of in all kinds of ways, and very explicitly drew upon them. And not just communist thinkers, but sort of canonical, sort of new left thinkers, or rather thinkers who became the sort of iconic thinkers of the new left, like sort of Frantz Fanon. I mean, they drew upon them, and so there is clearly, you know, there are clearly deeper correspondences of a way of looking at the world. Look, the left has always posed as being anti-fascist. This is not true. This is a complicated thing to unpick, and I'm sure many of you know much more about this than I do. From where I'm sitting, both fascism and communism, you know, they come from very similar. They're very similar streams that have watered both of them over many decades, and the so-called anti-fascist communist left has always been drawn to violence, to death, to the uncontrolled totalitarian use of power, and to hatred of Jews. And I'm afraid to say that goes for the many Jews who were on the totalitarian left. They were impelled by hatred of Jews. So there are actually, when you look at it, many horrifying correspondences between the far left and the Islamists marching on the streets together. And the fact that they are now apparently very seriously divided over such issues as rights for gays or rights for women, doesn't alter that fact that underneath there are really important areas of correspondence between them.
I think everybody in the room knows somebody or is personally involved with worrying about certain trends that have taken place on campus in the last number of years in universities. There's a disturbing trend, really, and because I witness this every year, it stays in my mind, of kind of vilification and demonization of Israel that's essentially encapsulated when it comes to Israel Apartheid Week, which is run in campuses across North America every year, almost ritualistically now, in around February or March. And, of course, you're very familiar in England with academic boycotts of Israel, where Israeli scholars cannot get published simply by virtue of being Israeli. Universities can be pretty intransigent places, pretty stubborn places when it comes to ideological correctness. Academics often dig in their heels and don't allow for alternate opinions, even though the rhetoric of the university is as a place where all positions are meaningfully expressed. It's not always true. I have a few questions in this regard. Firstly, maybe you can explain to our audience the current situation in England regarding the relationship between the academy and Israel and the Jews. And I guess more on a larger level, what would you advise Jewish students to do? Sometimes there are biased atmospheres in classrooms. It's a very difficult problem for students, and I've had numerous conversations along these lines. If you're taking you're a Jewish student and you're taking a Middle East studies course in university, and you say something which does not conform with the ideological position of the professor, who is convinced, of course, that the problem and the only problem in the Middle East is the Israeli occupation, should a student who differs with this acquiesce, or should a student who differs with this make a fuss, and what are the consequences of such?
The situation in Britain vis-a-vis the universities and thinking about the Middle East is very, very difficult. As I've just been saying, the intelligentsia's default position is that Israel is an apartheid state or possibly even a Nazi state. And certainly, at the very least, is guilty of gross human rights abuses. That's on a good day. And there is no question but that on campus, campuses differ, obviously, as I'm sure they do in this country. Different campuses have different reputations and different characteristics. But generally speaking, it's often a very, very difficult situation for Jewish students who wish to identify themselves to a greater or lesser extent with the justice of Israel's cause. You ask a very difficult question. I don't know what I would advise a student who finds him or herself in this position of having to toe the line in terms of Israel, in what the student is required to write in essays and so forth. I have to say, though, I don't think this is a problem confined to the issue of Israel. I think there's a whole range of topics where you suspect that students are marked down if they don't toe one ideological line or another. It's very hard to prove this. Very, very hard to prove it. What would I advise a student to do? I mean, how can one ever advise anyone to do other than just tell the truth as they see it? You can never advise someone just to go along with lies. Never. Where that leaves a student is a very, very difficult situation. And ultimately, one likes to think that there are within the university, there are mechanisms for righting injustices of that kind. One suspects that they don't sometimes work. Ultimately, there is no option but to just take what's coming and, if necessary, go elsewhere. But I agree, it's not a satisfactory answer. I think Jewish students are in a very powerless position, running a gauntlet, either in the sort of intellectual sphere, as you're asking, or in the sort of personal sphere, just running the gauntlet of the kind of hatred that are displayed on college walls, at advertising meetings, and catcalling, and all the rest of it. Having said that, here's a great thing that happened at Cambridge University. I don't know whether you read all about this. There was one of these terrible motions came up at the Cambridge Union. Is Israel a rogue state? And you know, you don't even bother to look at it anymore because you know what's going to happen. But it didn't. It didn't happen. 75% of that audience voted no. What happened? One of the things that happened, apart from the possible brilliance, I wasn't there, possible brilliance of the defenders of Israel on this occasion, one of whom was a chap from the Israel embassy, who I'm sure is very good, and the other is a chap who's known to me. He is he's a young British Muslim, and he's one of the bravest boys that I know, because not only is he an anti-Islamist Muslim, but he is a pro-Israel Muslim, and he speaks and writes in favour of Israel. He spoke and wrote in favour of caste-led. I mean, I take my hat off to him. He is wonderful. So no doubt it was the brilliance of their expositions that did a lot of the good that evening. But there was a Jewish student who volunteered to speak for the proposition that Israel was a rogue state. And he got up and he said, Israel, apparently, he said, you can read it online, it's been flying around the blogosphere. He said, Israel is indeed a rogue state. It's a rogue state because there is no other state which goes to such lengths to protect the lives of Palestinian children when it goes to war against Hamas. He turned the whole thing on its head. He showed that Israel was uniquely moral. Uniquely moral. It is the most brilliant, brilliant speech. What's happened to that student? Well, he's been banned for life from the Cambridge Union Society. Why? Because he insulted Lauren Booth. Lauren Booth, the sister-in-law of the former Prime Minister Tony Blair. Lauren Booth, who goes to Gaza and has become, in fact, a Muslim recently. I'm sure the Islamic world is delighted to have her. They're very welcome to her. But she was appearing for the anti-Israel crowd at this debate, and this young man apparently insulted her, for which he's been banned for life from the Cambridge Union Society. Anyway, that aside, it's an example of what a Jewish student can do if he puts his creative mind to it and refuses to be cowed, and that is indeed what we must all do.
And yet we see often the trend is actually the reverse, where you have this very troubling phenomenon that a lot of criticism of Israel is sourced in Jews, where Jews themselves come to the forefront of anti-Israel criticism. That's true in this country. You have people like Naomi Klein. You have, of course, the Goldstone Report on Gaza, which is by Richard Goldstone, the Jewish South African jurist. What's your read on Jewish self-criticism? Is it a kind of shining example of Jewish moral honesty, the ability to turn a gaze on ourselves that is unflinching, which was really always the mark of Jews throughout history? That was one of sort of crowning achievements of Jewry. If you look at Jewish culture, Talmudic culture, the ability to self-criticize was seen as a mark of Jewish honesty. On the other hand, is it really actually now morphed into a form of politically correct masochism, where a kind of self-loathing in the immediate term and self-defeating in the long run?
Well, you know, this term self-hating Jews is such a misnomer, because I never met people who love themselves more inordinately. It's an appalling problem. I think I'm right in saying that the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement in Britain anyway would never have got off the ground were it not for the Jews. They're not just involved, they're leaders of this terrible activity, particularly in the universities, but not just in the universities. You say, is it a Jewish moral honesty? It is profoundly anti-Jewish, immoral dishonesty. And one of the most terrible things about what they're doing is that these are Jews who are... This isn't true in every case, but by and large, they're pretty etiolated Jews. They don't really have a connection with the community, not part of the community. They don't identify with the religion, with the culture. Many of them are the product of or are involved in marriages with non-Jews. So, you know, they have a pretty tendentious connection with Judaism. And yet they come out with all this anti-Israel stuff. It's not just anti-Israel stuff, it is lies and demonization about Israel. And they say that this is authentic Jewish values, that we, the proud to be ashamed to be Jews, are authentic. We are representing real Jewish values. The terrible tragedy of Israel is that it's perverted Jewish values. Jewish values have nothing to do with this. Jewish values are never about killing. Never about killing. Jewish values are embracing everybody. I mean, these people are Christian. They got the religion wrong. They know so little about Judaism. They think that Christianity is Judaism. It is really quite monstrous because they know, you know, they've never read the prophets. I mean, if they actually ever read the Torah, they couldn't possibly say what they're saying. It's simply not true. It is a moral duty upon Jews to defend Judaism, Jewish people. Nevertheless, they pose in this ghastly way. But the good news is that, I don't know whether you are aware of something called the Booker Prize, but it's Britain's premier literary prize. Well, to everyone's astonishment, it was won a few weeks ago by Howard Jacobson for a book called The Finkler Question. Now, I do recommend, if you want to really cheer yourself up, don't read my book, go and buy that one. Or rather, buy my book, but then as an antidote, read the other one. The Finkler Question, I mean, Howard he's an etiolated Jew. He's a Jew by ethnic descent. He has nothing to do with the religion. He doesn't much like Israel. I don't even know what he thinks about Israel, but I think he thinks it's probably pretty smelly. He doesn't think about it. But in the last few years, as the madness has accelerated, he writes for The Independent, which is it's even worse than The Guardian. It is virulently, virulently anti-Israel, virulently. He writes a regular column. He's a man of the left. He's loved by the left. And increasingly over the years, he's written these increasingly desperate columns about the madness in a very brave kind of way. Anyway, he's written this glorious, glorious, glorious novel, which is a satire on the proud to be ashamed to be a Jew Jews. And he skewers them completely, completely. And what he's understood is that they are not ashamed to be Jews. They're ashamed as Jews. Let me explain what that means. This is what's so pernicious about what they say. They're not ashamed to be Jews. On the contrary, they're proud to claim to be Jews. They only claim to be Jews when they're dumping on Israel. But at that point, they're very proud to be Jews because they can wrap themselves in the mantle of the Shoah, would you believe? And then they can say whatever they like about Israel, and they are impregnable. They're very proud on that occasion to be Jews. But they're ashamed as Jews because they say, we represent true Jewish ethics. And so it makes us ashamed as Jews to be a Jew, to be associated with people like myself or others who are really perverting Jewish ideals. Now, all this is monstrous and ridiculous, but Howard Jacobson has absolutely skewered them. But the final point I would make is this. This is unfortunately and most tragically, this is not a new problem. This is not a problem that's come out of this whole modern Israel, anti-Israel feeling. Throughout the history of Jewish persecution, at every stage, there have been Jews who, for a variety of reasons, have been in the forefront of doing the dirty business of the people who are persecuting the Jewish people. These are but the latest manifestations of that, and it's a terrible, terrible problem for us all, and one that we are not actually addressing. And the final point is that it's perhaps at its most awful in Israel, in the Israeli universities in particular. I mean, The Guardian, which, you know, virtually every week, every day, runs these terrible pieces about Israel. Very often they're getting it straight from Haaretz. It's a deformation of the Jewish people. I'm not sure whether there's any other people which goes in for this kind of... It's not self-criticism. Self-criticism is based on an honest interrogation of oneself. This is based on dishonesty. It's based on lies. It's based on a pathological inability to accept what is true and to insist instead upon what is untrue.
If we move across to, say, the normative Jewish community and examine the attitudes that many Jews have in times of unrest, I know that in England, you know, every time I visit England, I've been told by Jews there that there's a sort of fairly widespread attitude among British Jewry that they should work in very quiet ways. They even start whispering when they talk about it. Quiet ways. To combat anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism. And they consider this more effective than public protest. I had a friend here when the Lebanon War broke out in 2006, and there were Palestinians on the street in Montreal, and, you know, he said, you know, Jews don't march on the street, we make dinners. You know, there's always a dinner that we go to when we raise money, but there's a sense that we don't vocally, publicly protest things. And I know that you were critical of British Jewry in the Second Lebanon War. You wrote of what you called their shameful silence, some of which you attributed to their feeling ambivalent about Israel's right to defend themselves. I'm wondering if you think that we should speak our minds more publicly, more... perhaps abrasively, or do you think that quiet diplomacy is the right approach? Should we be more activist? Should we even take to the streets?
Well, you're absolutely right that the UK Jews have a very heads below the parapet at all times approach, and always have done. And it's in large measure because they've understood that's the deal with British society. That if you put your head above the parapet and show that you're not an Englishman, then you're done for. And in recent years, that's become kind of rarefied. It's become a slightly different manifestation of this, in that it's now okay, you know, when I was growing up, it was very unusual to see somebody wearing a kippah in the street in a non-Jewish area. Now it's kind of okay, because that's kind of considered a kind of, you know, it's their quaint way of life. And there are even public displays. You know, there's something called the Simcha in the Square, which has been established, which is in Trafalgar Square, I think at Hanukkah, a sort of celebration in a sort of multicultural kind of way. You know, so all these weird and wacky religions all have their thing, and Simcha in the Square is a Jewish thing. So I suppose that's an advance. But if you, as a British Jew, identify with Israel, that's it. You are not British. You are disloyal. Because you are identifying with Jewish peoplehood, and therefore you can't be British. Now, the British Jews have always understood that's the deal. And you see, going back to the mandate, going back to the Balfour Declaration in 1917, which was the beginning of modern Israel, as it were, Balfour was a Christian Zionist, and he supported the return of the Jews to their ancient homeland. But the British Jews fought it from the beginning because they thought that their Britishness, their British loyalty, would be called into question, and they'd be accused of dual loyalty, and their life in Britain would become very difficult. And they weren't wrong. They weren't wrong. It's true. So that's why they keep their heads below the parapet. And they also think that they can be more effective by going behind the scenes. So they will make pathetic representations en masse, quietly, to, say, the editor of The Guardian or the controller of the BBC. And they will have discreet meetings, and they'll put their case, and they'll be listened to with a great deal of respect and courtesy. And then they'll go away, and the people at The Guardian and BBC will say, thank God those terrible people have gone. And what this does is two things. First of all, it confirms the people who are prone to think that the Jews basically act as a kind of conspiracy, will confirm they do act as a kind of conspiracy. They do work behind the scenes. They do try to become the puppet masters. And secondly, what it doesn't do is tell the British public what the truth is. So it's, in my view, extremely unwise strategy. Now, you say, should we all change this? Should we become more abrasive? Should we become more public? Well, yes, more public, not more abrasive. One of the most trying things is to see very, very upset and emotionally overwrought Jews writing, or in other words, in some other way, making their voices heard in protest against what's happening, accusing one and all of anti-Semitism. It is one of the most awful things, because it's completely counterproductive, and no one actually can accuse other people of anti-Semitism, unless except in certain very specific circumstances, because most of the time we have no idea what the motivations of these people are. You don't do any good by attributing motive, which we don't know. What we should be doing is something very different. We should first of all be being very cool and very forensic about it, not abrasive, but being public, being open, being above the parapet, but taking people apart on the basis of evidence. What they have said that is demonstrably wrong, a lie, stupid, contradictory. Okay, so it should be factual, it should be calm, and it should be very, very solid. But I think something more than that is needed. So far, whether or not we do it well or badly, whether or not we do it with our heads below the parapet, or in the case of, say, Jews in the United States, the heads very much above the parapet, we're all playing on the wrong foot completely. That is to say, we're all on the back foot all the time. We're all playing defense. And we judge each other's performance by whether or not we have defended Israel better or worse. This is, in my view, completely wrong. We have nothing to defend. To say that we are, to assume that we have to defend means that we are on the back foot, that we think there is something that we are being accused of, that we have to say, no, we're not doing this. We're not killing little children. We are not starving the Palestinians out of Gaza. We're not committing genocide. Look at the facts, world. Look at the facts. Hopeless. They won't look at the facts. They will never look at the facts. They're incapable of looking at the facts. And by us saying, we're not really that bad, already we're on their territory, on their battleground. Already we are engaging in the argument, are we bad or not? Well, no, we're not. Excuse me, we should not be having that discussion. We should be putting them on the back foot. We're the people who are in the right. We're the people who actually have international law and justice on our side. We have history on our side. We have truth on our side. We have morality on our side. We stand for justice and truth. They, and I'm not talking about the Arabs, I'm talking about the West, they have injustice and untruth that they are standing for. And we should be accusing them. We should be saying to them, for example, how can you possibly justify the singling out of Israel for pressure to make compromises with people who have attacked it for the six decades, nine if you include pre-Israel mandate Palestine, and who are continuing to chuck the rockets. In any other area of life, in any other world conflict, any people who have been guilty of that kind of aggression, whatever cause they ever had, is forfeit. No one has ever expected the victims of exterminatory attack to make compromises with the people who are still trying to get rid of them. That is enforced surrender of the weak to the strong, of the good to the bad. Why are you doing it with Israel? We should be going further than that. We should be saying to our progressive friends and our progressive Jewish friends, why, Mr. and Ms. Progressive Person, why are you supporting the racist ethnic cleansing of every single Jew from a future state of Palestine? Why are you, Mr. and Ms. Progressive Person, ignoring the persecution and murder of Palestinians by Palestinians in Gaza? Why are you not mounting a boycott, divestment and sanctions campaign against the Palestinian Authority for educating its children into the incitement, murder and genocide of the Jews, a people who are a Palestinian Authority which is led by a Holocaust denier? There are many, many, many other examples I could give. I'm sure we could all come up with them. It's a way of looking at the thing differently. We should be saying to ourselves, we put them on the back foot. Why aren't we holding Arab apartheid weeks? Why aren't we showing what they have done and what they are doing? Why aren't we holding weeks devoted to the ethnic cleansing of Jews from Arab lands? Why aren't we devoting these weeks to the fact that no Jews can live in Saudi Arabia, that not one Jew will be allowed in Palestine? Why aren't we doing this? Because we don't think offence, do we? We only think self-defence. Well, as I say, I think that defensiveness is halfway towards accepting the enemy's proposition. And we all have to rethink not just the manner in which we are trying to fight for ourselves and for Israel, but we have to think the actual ground on which we are standing. We have to rethink it. We have to change the narrative.
I'm just interested, like, you know, we talk about the Jewish community. What do you think is the attitude of the non-Jewish person on the street, say, in England, and I don't know if you can speak to America, towards Israel? In other words, if you take it out of the elites and just talk about what would be your ordinary, would they be sympathetic? Would they be passive? Do you think there's a silent majority in the West that support Israel, or is that support waning?
Well, as I think I may have said earlier, the lower down the social scale you go, the more sane and decent people are. The problem comes when you find people with education. As soon as people have had a university education, particularly a recent university education, basically you find they go mad. Among ordinary working people in Britain, I can't speak for anywhere else, they don't know about the Middle East. They didn't know about Jews, never seen a Jew. But insofar as they ever think about it, they think, there are people who are surrounded by these crazies and they're trying to fend them off. Good on them. That's it. That's it. That's all they know. That's good enough for me. As you go up the social scale and the educational scale and you find people with conscience, people who are high-minded, the more high their minds, the more conscience they have, the worse they get, the more bigoted they get, the more irrational they get. Because of what I was saying earlier, I've come to the conclusion, because if you're high-minded, then you go in for dreams of utopia. You want to make a perfect world. And you then subscribe to ideologies. And the ideologies, basically, as I said before, they close your mind to reality and to evidence, and they fill it instead with dogma based on fantasies. And then when the fantasy doesn't work, when the utopia doesn't materialize, then the adherents of those ideologies then turn on scapegoats to take the brunt of the rage at the frustration of the perfect society which hasn't happened. And that's what you get as you go up the social scale. I'll never forget, this has nothing to do with Israel, but some years ago I was on a television show which has a panel of politicians and journalists and so on, and that answer questions from an invited audience on issues of the day. And it goes around the country into different parts. And on this particular occasion, we were in some utterly benighted, armpitville spot in the north of England, the sort of place which, you know, sort of it's been completely sort of overlooked by everybody, where people are out of work for sort of 9 million generations, where you know everyone is walking around with a grey face, and you know you want to get out of there as fast as possible. So I was on a panel of people who were all entirely on the other side of me on everything, something which is my lot in life. You know, I was just thinking, as I always do on these occasions, can I survive this hour without actually dying on stage of fright? And I looked at the audience and I thought, they are, you know, it is all so grim up here, and there isn't even a nice sort of restaurant to go to afterwards and that sort of thing. And, you know, can I get out of here fast enough, this awful place, this awful panel of sort of London metropolitan sneererati and me, versus, you know, the great unwashed? That's how I thought. Anyway, there's always a warm-up question before the program actually starts. And the warm-up question was about drugs. And it was delivered by a 16, 17-year-old in the audience. And he said something like, does the panel think that cannabis should be legalized? I think that was very much the topic of the time. So I thought, oh, here we go. So all the panel said, yes, of course it should be legalised. I mean, it can't be. It's so ridiculous to think that it shouldn't be legal, that it should remain criminal, and, you know, only the most sort of unsophisticated and stupid people can possibly think that. Okay. So it came to me, and I said, well, I think it should remain criminal. Anyway. Very patronisingly, the chairman of the guy who chairs this panel, Inquisition, then turns to the young man in the audience, and he said, "You know, young man, you've asked the question. What do you think?" And we all thought, "Oh, here it comes." And he said, "Oh, I think the panel's entirely wrong. I think cannabis kills people. It kills my generation. You don't know what you're talking about, you London people." It's amazing. It was the first time I realized that in order to find people who are sane and sensible and decent, you have to go to Armpitsville now in Britain. The place you have to avoid at all costs is Hampstead.
I'm laughing because I was invited to speak last summer in Hampstead. I'm going to ask you one last question. What do you think is the end game here regarding Islamism in the West? Do you feel that we will, try to find a way of putting this, to find our voice and become insistent on our values? Or are things going to get darker, where multiculturalism will actually morph into a complete abandonment of Enlightenment values? And you see little benchmarks of this in the culture, and you can see why people get excited, because the issues themselves, I think, are less important for their actual content than for what they represent. I'm talking here about things like the fatwa on Salman Rushdie, like the Danish cartoons, like the mosque at Ground Zero. In and of themselves, taken separately, I'm not sure that these things are... They're terrible for the people involved, no question. They're terrible for Mr. Rushdie. They're terrible for the creator of the cartoons, who was just this Danish guy in his 70s who just made these cartoons and no idea what hit him. And, of course, for the, you know, widows and widowers of 9/11, obviously a very painful subject. But on a macro level, maybe not as important as for what they represent about how we think about ourselves. So do you see our ability to regain the things that made us a thriving democracy, or is it a culture that slowly but surely is losing its self-respect?
You know, this is an impossible question to answer because it involves looking to the future, and I have enough trouble with analyzing the present, quite honestly.
Right, right.
I get myself into no end of hot water from that point of view. So anyway, but, you know, there are many ways of looking at this. You know, on the one hand, I think, as I so often do, of the 18th century, and I think to myself, if I was, you know, sitting around in a coffee house in the 18th century in London, I would be saying to someone like yourself, as we sat over our hot chocolate or whatever they had in those days, I'd be saying to you, it's all over, we're going down the pan, there's absolutely no hope, Britain is finished, Western civilization is over, look at it out there, look at the immorality, look at the illegitimacy, they're all, you know, dying of gin and so on. Because a lot of people thought like that. They really did think it was all over. And then it turned into the 19th century, one of the greatest periods of British power ever. So it could be that. It could be that. Or it could be Rome. Now, I don't know which of those two it's going to be. What I do know is that things change, that things are usually, that society is much more complicated than we think. And I've learned from a lot of experience that, you know, as it were, out the woodwork suddenly comes a way of thinking. You think, where did that come from? It came from, like, nowhere. But actually, it didn't come from nowhere. It came from years and years of people listening and thinking and something changing in their minds under the surface. So one can never tell at any one stage what actually is going on. Now, who would have thought, even 5 years ago, who would have thought that, I've forgotten now which the countries are, France, Belgium, the Netherlands, would have banned the burqa? Who would have thought it? The Netherlands, liberal country. Who would have thought that Switzerland would have banned the minaret? Switzerland, hitherto known for nothing more exciting than chocolate and the cuckoo clock, it banned the minaret. Who would have thought the Swiss had it in there? They don't even have any Muslims in Switzerland. So something is happening in Europe. Something is happening in Europe. Apropos of which, there is the leaders and the lead issue. Throughout the countries of Europe, including Britain, the lead, the ordinary people, are beside themselves with anxiety and fury and grief about what is happening to their countries and their culture. They understand very well that it's going down the drain. Now, how are they all going to respond? Because the lead, the leaders, are going in the opposite direction, particularly in Britain, particularly in Britain. Britain is out on its own. Literally, you know, it's sort of floating off somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic. But how are the people of Britain and Europe actually going to respond 5-10 years down the line when things get worse, because they will get worse? Social disorder between Muslim and non-Muslim will be far worse. I mean, in France, I don't know, I've not researched this myself. I'm told that in Paris, you can go into certain streets and, you know, you are told it's a no-go area for non-Muslims. And you can see it's coming in Britain. as well. How are the ordinary people going to respond? Are the ordinary people of Britain and Europe going to say, well, it's a bit of a shame, you know, Western civilization was nice while it lasted. Britain had certain rather nice points that we're going to miss, but basically we'll buckle down now and, you know, become dimmies, and that's, you know, just the way it goes, really. Are you going to say that? Possibly. They're all going to go and live in Australia? Possibly. Or are they going to fight? Possibly. If they fight, what's going to happen? It's going to be extremely ugly. Extremely ugly. I'll tell you what's going to happen. I can see it happening now in Britain. In the first instance, the fight will be between the fascists and the Islamo-fascists. And which side are we going to be on? Liberal society has absented itself for a whole variety of reasons we've been discussing this evening. Multicultural obsession, fear of becoming, thinking of yourself as anti-racist, and all that sort of stuff, all the politically correct stuff. Liberal society says, we're not going to go there. So the only people who are taking up the cudgels are, I'm afraid, people who can be represented as racist but are not, but real racists. Real racists. And where are we going to be? What side are we going to be on? I pose the question, I don't have the answer. I can't ever see myself being on the same side as people who hate Jews, who hate people because of the colour of their skin. I can't see it. But what's going to happen? That's what's going to happen. That's going to be the polarisation. It's going to be very, very ugly. Now, at some point, this may not happen. At some point, maybe governments will come to their senses. At some point, governments will say, enough. You already see it. In Australia, John Howard did this for a while. The chap Abbott, who lost so narrowly the election of a few weeks ago, would also do it. They will stand and they will defend Western society. And maybe that will help turn the rest of the West. I don't know. So the answer is, I don't know. Things at the moment don't look very good. They don't look very good here either. By here I mean the continent of North America. It's happening very fast. I'm watching what's happening in the US. I can see very, very similar things happening to Britain. The demographic is quite different. The Muslim communities in America and Britain are very, very different, operating in different ways. But when I say the same thing is happening, it's the mindset of the ruling elite to appease, to say, if we give them a bit, then they won't hate us so much. It's a terrible fallacy. Will they come to their senses? It depends. It depends on a whole variety of things. But I do think that one can't put all that in one box and the issue of Israel in another box. Israel's fight is the West's fight for all kinds of reasons that we've been talking about this evening. The issue of Israel stands at the very centre, in my view, of the repudiation of reason in the West and the fight for truth and justice in the West. And it stands literally, geopolitically, at the very front line of the defence of the West against the Islamic Jihad. And so Israel is the absolute focal point of our times, Jew and non-Jew. It seems to me, now it's a kind of rule of thumb that I have, I can almost invariably tell where people will stand on the issue of Israel from where they stand on a whole variety of social and cultural issues which fall under this umbrella of ideology. And similarly the other way around, that if they are anti-Israel, they are basically going to be on the side of injustice and lies when it comes to all these ideologies too. So Israel is absolutely the central issue of our time, and that's why, you know, we have to fight it for those double reasons, both as Jews and as upholders of all those Western values that we all hold so dear.
So my family would like to invite everybody downstairs to a reception. Melanie's books are going to be on sale there, and she will sign them. and you'll have a chance to speak to, with her a little more at length. For now, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.